Philip II of Macedonia, the Battle of Chaeronea, Part 1. Now, both sides were reluctant to risk battle, and we must remember that pitched battles were rare events, even if they inevitably attract far more attention than the small-scale raids and skirmishes. Battles were unpredictable and tended to have dramatic consequences, winning or losing the whole campaign basically in an hour or so. In this case, the Theban high command appeared determined that Philip should attack them on ground of their own choosing and were unwilling to force a battle by launching an attack of their own. In the past, plenty of campaigns have been decided when one side withdrew after days or weeks of confrontation, rather than risk a battle on equal, let alone unfavorable, terms. And this was surely their hope. And again, we should remember that the reputation of the Theban army was very high, not least in the Thebans' own minds, and Philip was merely the leader of a hitherto poorly regarded northern kingdom. For several months, Philip had made no serious aggressive move, no doubt reinforcing the Thebans' confidence. Instead, he sent envoys to Thebes and Athens asking for peace. He was probably sincere. Failure to take cities on the Thracian coast was unfortunate, as was losing his plunder to the Triballi. But a defeat in a battle on this scale against these opponents would be far more damaging, perhaps undoing all the work he had done in the last two decades. While he was unwilling to concede anything significant, he is unlikely to have made any major demands and simply wanted peace, with all sides keeping what they held. Some of the leaders of the two cities were aware of the stakes and doubted that the potential gains were worth the risk. In Athens, Phocion, the same man who had led the fleet against Philip in 340 BCE, recommended acceptance, and there were probably other voices echoing his views, as there were in Thebes. If Philip withdrew and peace was agreed, then this would be an honorable outcome in a war in which the Athenians and Thebans had made it clear that they were willing to face him. Unsurprisingly, however, Demosthenes did not agree and led the criticism. Opinion in Athens shifted his way, and he even proposed sending ambassadors to the Thebans to ask them to let the Athenians march through Boeotia and fight Philip on their own, denouncing the Theban leaders as traitors to the Hellenes. Whether shamed in the fighting or seeing the king's caution as fear, both cities rejected Philip's peace offer. In early August 338 BCE, the two armies were camped a mile or so apart near Chaeronea. The allied numbers are uncertain, but most scholars follow Justin's statement that Philip was outnumbered and estimated the allied infantry at some 30 to 35,000, supported by some cavalry, who may have matched the Macedonians in numbers, but were inferior in quality. Athens sent perhaps 10,000 men as its contribution. Thebes probably somewhat more, and there were mercenaries and allied contingents from several states. Among the ranks of the Athenians was Demosthenes, carrying a shield with the slogan, "Good Fortune," in golden lettering, and Phocion was also one of the commanders. The Thebans included the 300 men of their elite sacred band, one of the few units of full-time soldiers outside of Sparta or Macedon. Later tradition claimed that they were recruited from 150 pairs of lovers, a special bond between partners stronger than mere comradeship. But this is unlikely to have been strictly true and may simply be part of a larger Athenian tradition that depicted the Boeotians as odd. In practical terms, it's difficult to see how this would have worked after the first batch of recruits, and most likely the story grew from discussions of an ideal phalanx. For Greeks, or at least Athenian aristocrats, a phalanx of such men ought never to flee, for not only would there be the passion of love, but even more importantly, at least in their eyes, the desire that neither lover be shamed by abandoning his partner by flight. The imagery is powerful and may explain why the sacred band figures far more prominently in modern discussions of Greek warfare than the meager evidence that it should ever justify. In a similar vein, much has to be said for the Battle of Chaeronea, even though almost nothing is actually known about it, for our sources are more than usually limited for such a pivotal event. Two monuments, a mound containing the cremated remains of the Macedonians who fell, and a burial topped by a statue of a lion that was held to be the Theban monument and covered the skeletons of at least 255 men to help confirm the general area of the battlefield. It is a considerable leap of faith to use these to establish positions of battle lines, since monuments of this sort are rarely tied precisely to locations of the actual fighting. We have fuller descriptions of Alexander's army in major battles in the Persian War just a few years later. Using these to guess at the composition of Philip's army is more justified, at least if done with caution. But it's still rash to take the tactics adopted against the cavalry-strong Persians and assume that these were employed in the same way against a very different opponent of a hoplite army in a far less open country of Greece. We cannot even be sure how much our sources actually knew, for the account in Theodorus Siculus is vague even by his standards. Plutarch was a native of Chaeronea and preserved a few local traditions of Alexander's tree where the prince is supposed to have pitched his tent, and a stream named the Hamon because it flowed with blood. After more than four centuries, it would have been hard for anyone to know the truth behind such tales, especially as Chaeronea had witnessed other major battles in the years between that might have easily confused tradition. So now we have everybody in place, so it's time for the battle, at least what we think took place. Now the sources for this, the Politics by Aristotle, the Histories by Herodotus, Histories, 12 volumes, by Diodorus Siculus, Peloponnesian War by Thucydides, and The Lives by Plutarch. Philip and Alexander, Kings and Conquerors by Goldsworthy. History of Macedonia, Volume 1 and Volume 2 by Hammond. In the Shadow of Olympus, The Emergence of Macedonia by Borgia. So I hope you enjoyed that. And as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment. Check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.